Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Samuel chapter 27. We're going to see how David flees from southern Judah over to the land of the Philistines to try to escape the murderous hand of Saul. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, David has spared Saul's life at Hakilah, which is in the hill country right east of Ziph, right west of En-Gedi. And there David was sleeping amongst his 3,000 choice troops with a spear stuck at his side and a water jug by his head, and David took him without killing Saul, thus twice sparing Saul, because he also had done it earlier at the cave of En-Gedi. Spared Saul's life, but it didn't matter. Saul, he says, "Oh, I'm so sorry, David, we're friends now," but then the next thing you know, he's chasing him again. David knew he had to get out of town, and so he did. And he goes to the Philistines. So that's where we are in chapter 27, starting with verse 1. Then David said to himself, "Now I will perish one day by the hand of Saul." And that's true. "There is nothing better for me than to escape into the land of the Philistines. Saul then will despair of searching for me any more in all the territory of Israel, and I will escape from his hand," which is exactly what happened. However, all the commentators, or most of them, are united in their moral dudgeon that David committed a sin by fleeing Saul from Judah and going to the Philistines. Now, let me read you some of the comments of these commentators. And I'll tell you right now, despite the fact that most people thought that David did something bad, I'm going to take the opposite side and say David did exactly the right thing, and he knew what he was doing, and he had to do it. So let's read the commentators. Here's John Gill. "These were the carnal reasonings of his mind, of David's mind, under the prevalence of unbelief, and shows what poor weak creatures the best of men are, and how low their graces may sink as to exercise when left to themselves." So David is an unbeliever, he's a poor weak creature, his grace is sunk very low, according to John Gill. Adam Clark says this, "God had hitherto confounded all Saul's stratagems, and it was not at all likely that he would now abandon him. There was now no additional reason why he should withdraw from David his helping hand." Jameson Foss and Brown say this, "This resolution of David's was, in every respect, wrong. It was withdrawal of his counsel and aid from God's people." Here's Adam Clark again. "There is not one circumstance in this transaction that is not blamable. David joins the enemies of his God and of his country, acts a most inhuman part against the Geshurites and Amalekites without even the pretense of a divine authority, tells a most deliberate falsehood to Achish, his protector, relative to the people against whom he had perpetrated this cruel act, giving him to understand that he had been destroying the Israelites, his enemies." We're going to see that in just a minute. "I undertake no defense of this conduct of David. It is all bad, all defenseless. God vindicates him not. The inspired penman tells what he did, but passes no eulogium upon his conduct. And it is false to say that, because these things are recorded, therefore they are approved." Well, Adam Clark's right about that. They're not disapproved either, so that leaves room for speculation, which we're going to do. Clark continues, "In all these transactions, David was in no sense a man after God's own heart. Chandler attempts to vindicate all this conduct. Those who can receive his saying, let them receive it." Well, I can receive Chandler's comment, although I haven't read Chandler. I don't know who he's referring to, but some people have vindicated David, but not most. Here's what Adam Poole said, quote, David forsakes the place where God had settled him and given him both assurance and experience of his protection there. Well, he's referring to 1 Samuel 22:5. This is when David is in Moab, had taken his mother and father over there for the protection under the king of Moab, and he was at Mizpah of Moab. Prophet Gad shows up over there and tells David, "Don't live in your fortified camp. Go to the land of Judah." So David went to the forest of Hereth, which is right south of the cave of Adullam in Philistia, or it's on the edge of Judah and Philistia. So David left Moab and went back to Judah. And so the idea behind these critical commentators, these commentators with a critical spirit of David, the idea is he should have stayed there in Judah, despite the fact that Saul was chasing him, God had protected him before, he'll continue to protect him, and besides, Gad told him to go to Judah. Well, let's look at five arguments in favor of the commentators, in favor of the idea that David was a bad boy. First one, the prophet Gad had told him to go into Judah when David was in Mizpah Moab. I just mentioned that. Well, my response to that is, Gad meant for David to stay in Judah permanently? Come on. He just told him to go into Judah. He didn't say, stay there forever and ever, no matter what happens. That's a dumb argument, in my humble opinion. Second argument in favor of the idea that David was a bad person. David had been miraculously preserved already in the land of Judah. That's true. My answer to that is, so if God miraculously preserves you somewhere, you're supposed to stay there forever? God miraculously preserved Jesus in the wilderness. Is Jesus supposed to stay in the wilderness forever? That is also a dumb argument, in my humble opinion. Here's the third argument in favor of the idea that David was acting outside of the approval of God. The last time David was in Gath running from Saul, David was totally insecure. That was when he had to feign madness in order to survive, 1 Samuel 21:13. This is when David had just left Israel. We left Nob, actually. He goes to Gath, 1 Samuel 21:13. So he, David, had disguised his sanity before them and acted insanely in their hands and scribbled on the doors of the gate and let his saliva run down his beard. Yeah, he was insecure when he was in Gath. And how secure was he in Judah? He was pretty darn insecure there, too. That's not a good argument to complain about David running back to Gath. You say, well, he was stupid. He shouldn't have gone back to the Philistines because the Philistines would have put him in danger. Yeah, they did. But as it turned out, everything worked out just fine. And as a matter of fact, David's stratagem in fleeing to the Philistines worked out in such a way that the kingdom of Israel was knocked over not by David, thus bringing down on David's head the charge that he would be a regicide and a fomenter of civil war, but the fall of Saul's illegitimate kingdom of Israel was occasioned by the Philistines. And we'll see that as we go on. So that's not a good argument that David was running into an insecure situation. That was argument number three in favor of David being a bad boy. Here's argument number four. David had just complained to Saul that being forced into an idolatrous land was bad. And so why did he go there into that idolatrous land of the Philistines? We read in 1 Samuel 26:19. This is when David has met Solomon, or is talking to Solomon across the valley there, the two crags at Hakalah. David says, "Now therefore, please let my lord the king listen to the words of his servant. If the Lord has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering." And that can be interpreted one of two ways, as I said in the last audio, but let's just assume here that what David is saying, look, if I've done something wrong and God has stirred you up to get me to execute God's justice, well, let's give him an offering. Don't kill me. Let's quit fighting. But if it is men, in other words, if it's Saul's advisors, cursed are they before the Lord, for they have driven me out today so that I would have no attachment with the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go serve other gods. And so the argument is, David has just said it would be bad to go into a pagan land where you have to serve other gods, but he did it. Well, the answer to that is quite simple. It wasn't David's fault that he was, quote unquote, driven out of Judah. He didn't voluntarily go to the Philistines. He was driven out of Judah by these very men, these very counselors of Saul, who were saying, Saul, go get the boy. Go get him. Another dumb argument. That's four dumb arguments, folks, saying that David was a bad person. Here's dumb argument number five. This is from Benson. I think, universally censored by commentators, David was universally censored by commentators, on account of his neglecting to consult God, either by his priest or by his prophet, before he fixed upon the flight to the Philistines. Well, here's the answer to that. Are we supposed to believe that every movement is supposed to be preceded by a priest or a prophet's consultation? And maybe David did inquire, it just wasn't recorded in the books. That's an argument from Silas, we don't know. But just because you do something and it doesn't say David inquired first of Gad or David inquired of the Urim and Thummim, maybe he just prayed to God and God revealed it to him. Another, I wouldn't say this is a totally weak, a dumb argument, but it's very weak. So that's five dumb to weak arguments in favor of David being a bad person. I would suggest to you that perhaps David was using wisdom, foresight, and common sense in getting out of Dodge. Can we really blame David for this? Here's what Benson says, even though Benson doesn't like what David did. He says that David was, quote, weary of wandering, weary of struggling with Saul's implacable spirit, weary of the unequal conflict between too dangerous generosity and too relentless malice. In other words, Saul sometimes would be saying, okay, David, that's fine. And then sometimes he'd come after him trying to kill him. David was weary of subsisting by the spoils of his enemies or bounty of his friends. Well, yeah. And I say to all these commentators who are sitting in their ivory tower, they're dead now, but if when they were sitting in their ivory tower reading this, what would you have done? You would have stayed there and just let Saul come get you and relied on God. Well, in my opinion, that's the counsels of perfectionism, a super spiritual answer. Now, they might be right. but I don't think they are. And as I said earlier, even if David was acting in unbelief, things turned out quite well, as Jameson Fawcett Brown admits when they say, quote, "It," that's David's fleeing to the Philistines, "was a movement, however, overruled by providence to detach him from his country and to let the disasters impending over Saul and his followers be brought on by the Philistines." In other words, it would be the Philistines who kill Saul, not David. If David had killed Saul and taken over his kingdom, he never would have been able to rule. He never would have had political peace and stability. And one last point. Just because God had preserved David in Israel and Judah, that didn't mean that God didn't want to preserve David in Philistia. Yes, he did preserve David in Judah. But is that an argument for saying that David needs to stay in Judah because that's where God preserved him in the past? God can preserve David in Philistia too, and as a matter of fact, did so quite well, despite the overwhelming odds against David's success. We go now to 1 Samuel chapter 27, verses 2 through 4. So David arose and crossed over, he and the 600 men who were with him, to Achish the son of Maach, king of Gath. And David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, each with his household, even David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's widow. Now it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, so he no longer searched for him. The first detail we notice is that when David left the area of Maon and Carmel and Ziph and Hakalah, which is basically southeast of Hebron, and he crossed over, he crossed over to the west there to Philistia, he had 600 men with him. Well, that's the same amount of men he had since Keilah, which is all the way back in 1 Samuel 23. That was when David delivered the people of Keilah from people who were Philistines, who were attacking Keilah, and they nevertheless betrayed him to Saul. And so that's the thanks David got, and he had to leave Keilah. And it says there in 1 Samuel 23:13, then David and his men, about 600, arose and departed from Keilah. So he started out with 400. He ends up with 600 after Keilah, and he's still got 600. He hasn't lost any, but he hasn't gained any either in his flight from Saul. And so he goes to Gath. Now, Gath, let's do some geography here. Gath is about 20 miles northwest of Hebron. And, of course, Hebron was just about 5 miles northwest of Ziph. And that Ziph was the area, the Ziphites were the ones who had betrayed David to Saul so many times. And then south of Ziph, another 4 or 5 miles, you got to Carmel. That's where David's wife Abigail was from. That's where he married her anyway. And then about a mile south of there is Maon, is where Abigail was married to Nabal. So that's the general area where he was. And now he's way over here, 20 miles to the northwest of Gath. Gath is at the head of the Valley of Elah. Gath is about 7 or 8 miles south of Ekron. Gath and Ekron were two of the famous five Philistine cities. Gaza, Ashdod, and Ascalon were the other three. About 5 or 6 miles north of Gath and Ekron, if you look about 4 miles to the east is Timnah. That's where one of Samson's love interest was from, because Ekron is right at the bottom of the Valley of Sorek. That's where the exploits of Samson took place. And so that's generally where we are now, in the land of the Philistines. One way to keep all this territory straight is by valleys. The Valley of Sorek is where Samson did his exploits. And then south of the Valley of Sorek, about 6, 7, 8 miles, depending on where you are, you get to the Valley of Elah. And that's where David killed Goliath. Socah is right down there at the head of the Valley of Elah. So the king of Gath at this time was a man named Achish. Now, the question arises, why would David go to Achish? The last time he went to Achish in Gath was in 1 Samuel 21, 10 through 15, when he was fleeing from Nob because Doeg the Edomite was going to betray the information to Saul that David had been at Nob. And so he had headed out to Gath. That was the first place he went when he fled from Israel. Now, when he got there, the counselors of Achish didn't trust him. They said, "This is an Israelite. Why are you putting up with this guy?" And so David realized he was about to get caught, and so he feigned madness from getting killed. You recall that story. And so since it was so dangerous before, why did David go back there? Well, here's some options to possibly answer this. It might have been a different Achish than before. Gill and James Fawcett Brown. Gill says this, "Seems as if he was not the same, since he is described as the son of Maok as if it was to distinguish him from him. In other words, the first Akish from the second Akish. Well, that's an idea, but not even if it's the same Akish, circumstances greatly changed. Before, David went secretly into Gath, but now he came openly. Before, David was unknown. Now he was getting famous. He had whipped up on the mighty Saul a good bit. Before, David went into Gath alone. Now he came with 600 fighting men. Before, David had gone into Gath to see Akish uninvited. But this time, perhaps it was different. Akish perhaps invited him, as Jameson Fawcett Brown suggests. Perhaps Akish saw in David a useful enemy to Saul. Because after all, David's gotten a name for himself whooping up on Saul. Perhaps David negotiated with Akish for a safe entry. He's saying, look, Akish, I can help you, boy. I can help you. Because I'm fighting Saul. You don't like Saul? Why don't you let me in? I think that makes a lot of sense. That's not so improbable that David would go back to Gath. Now, in verse 4, it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, so he, Saul, no longer searched for David. And so David's plan worked out perfectly. Saul got off his case. Why did Saul quit chasing David? Well, David's in enemy country now. Saul just can't go marching into Philistia without a battle. Also, David posed no threat to Saul when David is in Philistia. How could David raise troops to make a strike for the kingdom? As soon as he would do that, all the people in Israel would say, he's fighting for the bad guys. We're not going to support him. So, David, by his flight, solved the Saul problem. Saul can't advance into Philistia, and David is now out of Saul's hair. He can't attack Saul back in Israel. And so Saul goes back to Gibeah. Ha ha, we've gotten rid of David. We go down to 1 Samuel chapter 27, verses 5 through 6. Now, David said to Akish, if I found favor with you, let me be given a place in one of the outlying towns so I can live there. Why should your servant live in the royal city with you? Your servant, of course, David's referring to himself. That day, Akish gave Ziklag to him, and it still belongs to the kings of Judah today. Now, David said, let me be given a place, which turned out to be Ziklag. Well, who gave him that place? Well, it could have been Akish with the consent of his nobles, and of course, that would prevent jealousy from arising against David. Hey, let's give this guy, he might be helpful to us, but let's give him a place out of town. Or it could have just been Akish doing it by himself. Hard to know what the politics are here. But now, why was David looking for a special place for his retinue of 600 people? Well, first of all, it would prevent jealousy from the courtiers of Akish. Remember that same jealousy that forced him to feign madness in order to escape from his first visit to Gath. David would be away from the king, out of sight and out of mind if he lived outside of Gath. He'd be away from palace intrigues. He would not be looked upon as being favored by Akish, which would cause political animosity. So he'd be out of sight, out of mind, no palace intrigue. That's one reason. Also, David might have wanted to preserve his 600 people from idolatry. There would be plenty of invitations to idolatry at the court of Akish. A third reason why perhaps David left Akish is because David could secretly attack the enemies of Israel who were the friends of Akish, which we're going to see is exactly what he did. Akish wouldn't be able to track David, wouldn't be able to control him, and David could go out there and whip up on the bad guys who are allied with Akish, and Akish would be powerless to stop him. Now, in verse 5, David tells Akish, why should your servant live in the royal city? David is presenting himself as one who wants to not burden Akish. Now, 600 men and their families might seem to crowd the city. I imagine it would. And it would also show Akish that David is not going to be a rival for power. He was smart to ask for a place outside of Akish. So Akish and his nobles gave him a Ziklag. Now, where is Ziklag? Well, Gath is way up here in the valley of Elah, and if you go about 20 miles to the southwest, you come to Ziklag, which is basically sort of in low hills or plains there in the south. Ziklag was first given to the tribe of Judah in Joshua 15. Afterwards, it was given to Simeon in Joshua 19, but then somehow the Simeonites lost Ziklag to the Philistines, which doesn't surprise me. There's a lot of cities that the Israelites did not conquer from the Philistines. So David's down in Ziklag. Now in verse 6, we read, that day Akish gave Ziklag to him, gave it to David, and it still belongs. Ziklag still belongs to the kings of Judah today. Now that phrase, to this day, leads Adam Clark to say this, quote, this verse is a proof that this book was written long after the days of Samuel, and that it was formed by a later hand, out of materials which had been collected by a contemporary author. Albert Barnes says this, quote, this phrase, Ziklag has been owned by the kings of Judah to this day. This phrase, coupled with the title the kings of Judah, implies that this was written after the revolt of Jeroboam, because the phrase kings of Judah would refer to the kings of the southern Israel, and it was written before the Babylonian captivity. Well, the kingdom split at the time of Jeroboam in 930. Jeroboam ruled from 931 to 910. So that would put the authorship somewhere around, say, 930 or so. And of course, that's Thiele's date for Jeroboam. Albright's got a different date. So somewhere in the early 10th century is a good date for Samuel. I don't have any problem with that. We go now to 1 Samuel 27, 7 through 8. The number of days that David lived in the country of the Philistines was a year and 4 months. Now David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites and the Girzites and the Amalekites, for they were the inhabitants of the land from ancient times, as you come to Shur, even as far as the land of Egypt. First of all, the time reference here, year and 4 months, David's in the land of the Philistines. That literally is days and 4 months. And John Gill says, days and 4 months, sometimes that days is sometimes put for a year, so it would be a year and 4 months. But some people don't interpret it for a year. They say it's a few days out of the fifth month, so it would be days and 4 months. So days of one month and then 4 months after that. And according to the Septuagint and the Vulgate, it was only 4 months, not a year and 4 months. Well, okay, little dispute over that, just as a matter of history. Now David and his men, verse 8, went up and raided the Geshurites and the Girzites and the Amalekites. We need to remember that, GGA, Geshurites, Girzites, and Amalekites. Those were all friends of David's protector, Achish. Now there's a problem with the Geshurites. The Geshur is a well-known area right in the Golan Heights, east of the Sea of Galilee, right past those heights there, those hills there, in the tribe of East Manasseh. John Gill assumes that David went that far to invade the Geshurites. He says, the Geshurites were, quote, some of the old inhabitants of the land of Canaan, the remains of the Amorites, whose land was given to the half-tribe of Manasseh, but could never be expelled, and therefore David had a just right to invade them, and if he could, either expel or destroy them. These are the Geshurites which are joined with the Philistines. So Gill has no problem with David going way up there to the northeast to attack the Geshurites. Wikipedia agrees and says also says that David invaded that far to the northeast. I was tempted to think that some Geshurites had migrated down to the south, because it sounds like it's all in the south. It says they, the bad guys, were the inhabitants of the land from ancient times. As you come to Shur, that's right on the border of Egypt, even as far as the land of Egypt. But I guess you could say it went all the way from the north, from the Golan Heights down to Shur. David was real busy. That's a long way. But we'll take it to be true, since John Gill and Wikipedia say that's what happened. Now, the Girzites that David attacked, these were the inhabitants of Gezer. Now, let's see where this Gezer is. If we look at a map and go the 20 miles or so back northeast to get to Gath from Ziklag, Gath being at the head of the Valley of Elah, or the bottom of the Valley of Elah. You go north on the road there about, I would say, 5 miles. You get to Ekron, the other famous Philistine city. That's at the Valley of Sorek, Samson's stomping grounds. And then you go about 7 miles or so to the northeast, and you get Gezer. So Gezer's a good bit north of Gath. They're called Girzites. The people of they're not Gezerites, they're Girzites. So that means David had gone way up to the Golan Heights, he'd gone north to the Girzites, and he also attacked the Amalekites. Now, the Amalekites are famous people, so I'm going to give you a summary of Easton's entry here for the Amalekites. They were a tribe that dwelt in Arabia Petraea. When you hear Arabia Petraea, that's Arabia of the Rock. Think between the dead and the red, between the Dead Sea and the Red Sea, the wilderness of Sin, the wilderness of Paran, and keep on going down, I guess, to the northern part of the Sinai Peninsula. So that's the Arabia Petraea. And the Amalekites were pastoral and hence a nomadic race. Their kings bore the hereditary name of Agag. Remember, Saul knocked off the Amalekites and refused to kill Agag. And so the second time at Gilgal, Saul got mad at him and said, the kingdom is torn from you. That was the same Amalekites that Saul had beaten. The Amalekites, going back to the time of the Exodus, attempted to stop the Israelites when they marched to their territory. They attacked them at Rephidim, which is right near Mount Sinai. They had the big battle where Moses held his hands up and Joshua clobbered the Amalekites as long as Moses held his hands up. The Amalekites afterwards attacked the Israelites at Hormah. That's on the Exodus. We read of the Amalekites subsequently as in league with the Moabites. That was in the story of Phinehas against Zimri and Cosby. Remember, he stabbed him in the tent because the Moabites were seducing them to idolatry. In the plains of Moab, under Moses, right before they crossed over, that was the Amalekites were joined with the Moabites. And they were joined with the Midianites, the same Midianites who were wiping out Israel that Gideon had to deal with. So they're constantly allied with people, or they themselves, by themselves, are constantly opposed to Israel all the way through. Sounds like the devil, constantly opposed to God. Saul finally desolated the territory, destroyed their power. David recovered booty from them. They show up in the ancient Near East inscriptions, like the Amarna tablets, that calls them the plunderers. So if anybody deserved to get clobbered, it would be the Amalekites. So that's David's activity, which is being carried out away from the watchful eye of Achish of Gath. We go down to 1 Samuel 27:9. David attacked the land, these three places, Geshur, Ezer, and the Amalekites. The Amalekites are sort of scattered down there. There's no one place for them. David attacked the land and did not leave a man or a woman alive, and he took away the sheep, the cattle, the donkeys, the camels, and the clothing. Then he returned and came to Achish, went back to Gath. Now, of course, he attacked the women. Oh, my gosh, how could David, a godly man, have been so cruel? Well, here's some options to answer that. David was continuing the practice of Kerem, cities that are devoted to God. Kerem means devoted to God. They're totally destroyed, as we see back in Joshua. And, of course, that brings up the question of the morality of the Israelites conquering these bad guys in Canaan. Did the Israelites commit genocide? And, of course, that is too broad a topic to tackle here. It's considered to be a weak point in Christianity. Atheists love to jump on Christians about this. I think it's kind of ironic. I mean, you know, we got a lot of modern people who justify dropping an atomic bomb on Hiroshima in World War II. The argument being it was necessary because the crazy Japanese were holed up in these islands. It would have taken 1 million American troops to get rid of dead. A million fatalities in order to get rid of the Japanese, so desperate times call for desperate measures. You could argue the same thing about the firebombing of Dresden, the firebombing of Tokyo. Some people justify that. Now, I realize it could be argued against, because a lot of people do. But if you say it was a military unjustified attack, that's one thing. But if you call it genocide, that's another. Genocide is when you deliberately go in and wipe out innocent civilians with no military purpose. Like, for example, what Pol Pot did to the Cambodians, what Mao Zedong did to the people in China during the Great Leap Forward, what Adolf Hitler did to the Germans, what Joseph Stalin did to the Kulaks in the 1920s. All of that is genocide, no question. But that's not what the Israelites did here. They did not just willy-nilly wipe out women and children. For one thing, if they were outside of the land of Canaan, they were told not to do that. The reason that they had to do it inside the land of Canaan was because the Canaanites were so firmly entrenched, their cup of the iniquity had been filling up for many centuries. They were killing their kids with Moloch sacrifice. They were totally sunk in the most barbaric practices of idolatry that God had to wipe them out in order to have a people that could give birth to the Messiah. He had to. Desperate times call for desperate measures. And here David had another reason, which was if he had allowed the women and children, or the women, it says here, alive, they would have gone and told people, and then would have gotten back to Achish, and David and his 600 men would be toast. They'd be killed. This was a military necessity, folks. Now, in verse 9, when it says that David did not leave a man or a woman alive, it means David killed all of his enemies that were within his reach, because some of these exterminated, quote-unquote, exterminated people show up again. For example, the Amalekites. 1 Samuel 31. Then it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag and had overthrown Ziklag and burned it with fire. So he didn't get them all, and the ones that he didn't get came back and burned his city down. So then in verse 9, the text says that David returned and came to Achish. Why did he go back to Gath? He had to give a false report to Achish of what he had been doing to keep up the ruse. We go now to 1 Samuel 27, verses 10 through 12, and we'll finish this chapter. Now, Achish said, "Where have you made a raid today?" And David said, "Against the Negev of Judah and against the Negev of the Jeremelites." Now, Negev just means south country, as the Holman Christian Study Bible translates it. "Against the Negev of Judah and against the Negev of the Jeremelites and against the Negev of the Kenites." Now, let's stop there. All three places that David tells Achish that he'd attack, they were all friends of Israel. Friends of David and enemies of Achish. So David basically lying here. Judah, of course, was the sworn enemy of Achish and the Philistines. The Jerahmeelites, who were they? Jerahmeel was a descendant, well, he was the son of Hezron, and Hezron was the son of Judah. So Jerahmeel was the grandson of Judah. That's John Gill says that. I kind of questioned that. It might be the descendant of Hezron, the descendant of Judah. I don't know if I'd be so tight as to say it's the grandson. But anyway, he was a Judahite and thus an enemy of Achish. And the Kenites that David lied about and said he had attacked, these guys are very friendly to Israel. Let's go over them again. After all, Moses had married into the family of the Kenites. The name means smiths. He's a metalsmith, a tinker. Kenites is the name, this is Easton's, the Kenites is the name of a tribe inhabiting the desert lying between southern Palestine and the mountains of Sinai. Again, that's Arabia Petraea. Jethro was of this tribe. Now, Jethro was Moses' father-in-law. Jethro is called a Midianite, and hence it is concluded that the Midianites and the Kenites were the same tribe. They were wandering smiths, the gypsies and traveling tinkers of the old Oriental world. They formed an important guild in an age when the art of metallurgy was confined to a few. They showed kindness to Israel in their journey through the wilderness. They accompanied them in their march as far as Jericho and then returned to their old haunts among the Amalekites in the desert to the south of Judah. We read about that when we went through Judges. They sustained afterwards friendly relations with the Israelites when settled in Canaan. The Rechabites, those are giants, belonged to this tribe of the Kenites, and in the days of Jeremiah are referred to as following their nomad habits. Saul bade them depart from the Amalekites when in obedience to the divine commission, he was about to smite Amalek. And the reason is, quote, for he showed kindness to all the children of Israel, Kenites, and showed kindness to all the children of Israel when they came up out of Egypt. So, the Kenites are very friendly to the Israelites, and David said, I've attacked them, Achish. Now, let's look at an issue. Was David fudging the truth here in such a way that he could be considered to be telling the truth? Notice he said the Negev of Judah. That's the southern end of Judah. That's sort of ambiguous. That could have not been, well, it could have sounded like David was attacking his old country of Israel. But Negev of Judah could mean the south country of Judah, the land south of Israel, so he's not actually attacking Israel. He's attacking the Amalekites down there at least, not the Geshurites and the Gerzites. But at least the Amalekites might have been down there south of Israel. And so he would not be attacking Judah. He would be attacking the south of Judah. But when he tells Achish that he was attacking the south country of Judah, it sounds like he was attacking Judah. Same thing with the Jerahmeelites. David came against the Negev of the Jerahmeelites, the south country of the Jerahmeelites. So it could sound like to Achish that David is attacking the country of the Jerahmeelites. Or it could be that David was secretly meaning south of the Jerahmeelites, which of course would not be the land of Judah. And then he said the Negev of the Kenites, he could say, well, I did attack the south country of the Kenites. I attacked the country south of the Kenites when I attacked the Amalekites. That would be a very, very, very fancy, what's the definition of is, it depends on what the definition of is type of defense, a legalistic type of defense, a Bill Clinton type of defense. I did not have sex with that woman because I had oral sex with her. That sort of legalistic tinkering with words. Even if it was true that David had done that, if he was fudging the truth here, it still does not absolve him of deceiving or lying to Achish, because a deception is as good as a lie. So I think that's a silly defense against David. However, against the charge that he shouldn't have lied. Now, there is a split of opinion on that. Some people say that David was not justified in lying, and some people say he was. Now, listen to Adam Clark. He's the one that usually gets himself up in a outrage about David. Quote, this deception, which Dr. Delaney says did harm to nobody. Dr. Delaney is a contemporary commentator of Clark. This deception, which Dr. Delaney says did harm to nobody, and to the account of which he is an utter loss, what degree of guilt to charge. This deception imposed upon Achish, Clark continues, had the most direct tendency to make him imagine himself secure while in the utmost danger, and to have a faithful friend and able ally in David while he was the veriest enemy he could possibly have. Shame on him, on Dr. Delaney, who becomes the apologist of such conduct. As to Dr. Chandler, he should know that no lie is of the truth, and that all falsity is an abomination to the Lord. This is the same puritanical streak that runs through commentators about lying. And it's often said that God is a God that's impossible to lie. That's because God doesn't have enemies who are threatening to take him off his throne and kill him. Nobody's going to kill God. But people like David have to live down here in the real world where there's warfare, and you have to use deception in warfare. David was at war with the Philistines. Stratagem is perfectly okay in times of warfare. I usually don't pick on my commentators that I've used so exhaustively during these podcasts, like Adam Clark. He's a great commentator, but then he says stuff like this, and I just feel like I got to say something about that. Well, some people say that he was justified because it was warfare. Since when is deception in warfare considered immoral? So even if David played fast and loose with the words Negev, that doesn't justify his conduct to me. What does justify David's conduct is he was at war and he had to do what was necessary. War is hell, folks. Ladies and gentlemen, with those opinionated words, I now finish our session for 1 Samuel 27. We now are ready to go to 1 Samuel 28, verses 1 through 25, and we will look at the old story of Saul and the Witch of Endor. Great story with lots of theological controversy. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.